This is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. It conducts innovative research and programs in health and nutrition, and it provides consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. It's been 40 years since the Center for Science in the Public Interest, Nutrition Action Health Letters publisher, opened its doors. And during that time, much has changed in the supermarket, on food labels, in restaurants, and in our rapidly expanding waistlines. Meanwhile, scientists have tossed out, overhauled, or generated brand new theories about food's impact on our health. In the cover story of the January-February 2011 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, Director of Nutrition Bonnie Liebman reports on unexpected, surprising findings from the last 40 years. One surprising finding made during the last 40 years is that excess pounds boost cancer risk. We've known since the 1960s about the very strong relationship between weight and endometrial cancer, says Alpa Patel, an epidemiologist who directs the Cancer Prevention Study 3 at the American Cancer Society. The endometrium is the lining of the uterus. But the attention to weight and many other cancers has really been drawn in the last 15 years or so. And the list of cancers linked to extra pounds keeps growing. In addition to endometrial, the evidence is strongest for postmenopausal breast cancer, as well as cancers of the colon, esophagus, kidney, and the pancreas. And based on what we know so far, adds Dr. Patel, there is a probable association for leukemia in adults, lymphoma, and ovarian, cervical, gallbladder, liver, and aggressive prostate cancer. It's not that researchers didn't think to look for a link between weight and cancer. They just got thrown off the track. One reason was that more postmenopausal women were taking estrogen, explains Dr. Walter Willett, chair of the nutrition department at the Harvard School of Public Health. Higher estrogen levels, either from pills or from fat cells, raise the risk of breast cancer. If your estrogens are high because you're taking the hormone, it masks the effect of overweight, notes Dr. Willett. The estrogen from extra fat cells does not make much difference if your levels are already high. A second reason was that being overweight lowers your risk of breast cancer before menopause, but it raises your risk of breast cancer after menopause. The relationship flips after menopause, explains Dr. Willett. And that was definitely not anticipated by anyone. So studies looked at all women, and they saw no clear link. And that made the situation murkier. Likewise, researchers missed the links between excess weight and prostate cancer because they did not look separately at aggressive cancers. The evidence suggests no association with localized, non-aggressive disease, what you traditionally think of as prostate cancer, explains Dr. Patel. But when you look specifically at high-grade or fatal prostate cancer, you see very consistent relationships with increasing weight. How much weight matters? Well, for cancers like colon and postmenopausal breast, there is a linear relationship, says Dr. Patel. With increasing weight, there is increasing risk. But for other cancers like pancreatic cancer, you have to reach higher levels of obesity. And for some cancers, the risk depends on where your body puts the extra fat. As with heart disease and diabetes, a wide waist is worse than wide hips. For pancreatic and colon cancer, being overweight and apple-shaped may be more harmful than being overweight and pear-shaped, says Dr. Patel. Exactly how obesity might increase the risk of cancer depends on the cancer. For prostate, breast, ovarian, and endometrial cancer, sex hormones like estrogen and testosterone seem to drive the increase, notes Dr. Patel. Extra fat cells may mean that the body churns out more cancer-promoting growth factors. For example, insulin may initiate and promote the progression of cancer growth, she explains. And insulin-like growth factor 1 is associated with increased cell growth. In other cases, nearby fat cells may be to blame. For adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, or cancer of the liver or gallbladder, Dr. Patel points out, local fat deposits may be detrimental. What's more, obesity may promote leukemia and lymphoma by boosting inflammation. In obesity, you have a constant, relatively mild inflammatory state, says Dr. Patel. Whatever the mechanism, many people are still surprised to hear that staying lean may trim your odds of getting cancer. I don't think the message is out there yet, the way it is for heart disease or diabetes, where people clearly know that if I'm heavier, I increase my risk for those chronic diseases, says Dr. Patel. The cancer message is much newer. And weight matters more than people realize. Even 15 years ago, it was not really appreciated how much weight is related to so many cancers, says Dr. Willett. The number of cancers is increasing. For any one person, smoking boosts cancer risk. more than being overweight. But for the nation as a whole, obesity matters as much, he notes. There are probably as many cancers caused by overweight and obesity in the United States as are caused by cigarettes, because there are fewer smokers than overweight people. Another interesting finding made during the last 40 years is the safety of coffee. A headline in the New York Times in March of 1981 announced, "Study links coffee use to pancreas cancer." Earlier studies had raised alarms that coffee might cause heart attacks. These days, however, coffee is sounding more like a wonder drug or wonder beverage. It has turned out to be remarkably safe, says Harvard's Walter Willett. The evidence is very clear that coffee does not increase the risk of pancreatic cancer, and it probably reduces the risk of liver cancer. In a 2007 meta-analysis, Swedish researchers estimated that people who drank 2 cups of coffee a day had about a 30% lower risk of liver cancer than those who drank none. Researchers do not know whether people who drink decaf also have a lower risk. But that's not all. Coffee almost for sure reduces the risk of type 2 diabetes, adds Dr. Willett. When researchers combined 9 studies on a total of nearly 200,000 people, they found that those who drank 4 to 6 cups of regular or decaffeinated coffee a day had about a 30% lower risk of diabetes than those who drank up to 2 cups a day. It looks like coffee reduces insulin resistance, notes Dr. Willett. If your cells are insulin resistant, they do not respond well to the hormone, and you have a higher risk of diabetes, heart disease, and gout. That could also explain why people who drink either decaf or caffeinated coffee have a lower risk of gout. Only caffeinated coffee may lower the risk of Parkinson's disease and gallstones. The mechanism is not clear, but the evidence is quite strong for Parkinson's, explains Dr. Willett. His bottom line is this: coffee has turned out to be a health-promoting beverage rather than a carcinogen. 40 years ago, vitamin D was just another run-of-the-mill nutrient. It was good for bones because it helps the body absorb calcium. These days, you can scarcely pick up a nutrition journal or magazine without finding a study about the benefits of vitamin D. From cancer, heart attacks, and stroke to type 2 diabetes, depression, and autoimmune diseases, it seems as though vitamin D can prevent almost anything. It's unquestionable that vitamin D has far more extensive biological effects than just the relationship with fracture risk, says Harvard's Dr. Walter Willett. A study recently found over 2,700 places for vitamin D binding sites on the genome, he notes. And there was a heavy concentration around genes related to autoimmune diseases like lupus, multiple sclerosis, and rheumatoid arthritis. That's pretty remarkable. And that's one reason why researchers at Harvard and elsewhere have launched the VITAL trial, which is giving either a placebo or 2,000 international units of vitamin D a day to 20,000 healthy older men and women. We are looking primarily at cancer and cardiovascular disease, but also at diabetes, depression, cognitive function, and autoimmune disease, says Joanne Manson of the Harvard Medical School, who is leading the study. Results are expected in the year 2016 at the earliest. So what do we do in the meantime? Well, in November, a panel of scientists at the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine announced that most people do not need to take vitamin D supplements. There's concern that vitamin D deficiency and inadequacy have been overestimated in the United States and Canada, explains Dr. Manson, who served on the panel. This is the problem. People go to the doctor for a physical and for blood tests and are told that their vitamin D level is below 30 nanograms per milliliter, so they should take high doses. It's difficult to get more than 200 or 300 international units of vitamin D from foods, even if they are fortified. So many people have to rely either on sun exposure, which can damage skin, or on a supplement. Then they're told to come back for another test and to take higher doses of supplements until their vitamin D blood levels rise above 30 or 40 nanograms per milliliter. And that is not a good idea. Why? Well, the panel was worried that taking high doses of vitamin D may be harmful. There is increasing evidence that there may be a risk at both low and high blood levels, says Dr. Manson. For example, a 2006 study of Finnish male smokers found a higher risk of pancreatic cancer among those with higher blood levels of vitamin D. And a 2009 study of mostly non-smoking U.S. men and women found a similar link. But curiously, it only showed up in people from states with low sun exposure. Harvard's Dr. Willett is not concerned. He says, if you do enough studies, you'll always find some associations. The National Academy of Sciences vitamin D report misinterpreted some evidence and raised alarms unnecessarily, he argues. It was like they were dredging the whole data set to look for harm and to discount any benefit. Randomized clinical trials should answer the question, says Dr. Manson. Until we have large-scale trials of high doses of vitamin D, we should be cautious. We should not forget the lessons of other nutrients, like beta-carotene, where large doses showed no benefit and even caused harm in smokers. But the controversy should not matter to most people. What got lost in many headlines is that the panel actually raised the recommended dietary allowance of vitamin D from 400 to 600 international units a day for adults up to the age of 70, and it was raised from 600 to 800 international units for people over the age of 70. Our advice is to take a daily supplement with the new recommended dietary allowances. They should be safe. In fact, the report boosted the tolerable upper intake level, the highest safe daily dose, from 2,000 to 4,000 international units. That way, if vitamin D turns out to prevent disease, you are covered. What's more, taking a supplement is safer than getting more sun. UV, ultraviolet exposure, is a carcinogen that is related to skin cancer and to skin aging, warns Dr. Manson. 30 or 40 years ago, who would have suspected that too little sleep could show up on your bathroom scale? Today, we sleep less and we weigh more. And the two may be related. The average American now sleeps 1 or 2 hours less per night than he or she did 40 or 50 years ago. In the year 1960, an estimated 16% of young adults slept fewer than 7 hours a night. Today, that percentage has increased to 37%. We now have lots of studies on sleep and obesity, explains Kristen Knutson, assistant professor of medicine at the University of Chicago. And most find that short sleepers are more likely to be obese than longer sleepers. A short sleeper, she notes, is someone who typically sleeps fewer than 6 hours a night. But the link is stronger if you look at just 5-hour-a-nighters. For example, in a study that tracked more than 68,000 women, those who slept fewer than 5 hours a night were 32% more likely to gain roughly 30 pounds over the next 16 years than those who slept at least 7 hours a night. To find out how sleep deprivation might alter fat deposits, Dr. Knutson and her colleagues enrolled volunteers who slept overnight in a laboratory. When they were allowed to sleep for just 4 hours a night, for 1 or 2 nights, the researchers saw more ghrelin, a hormone that increases appetite, and less leptin, a hormone that tamps down appetite, than when the volunteers were allowed to sleep for 9 hours. We also asked each person, "Are you hungry during the day?" notes Dr. Knutson. After 2 days of short sleep, people were hungrier than after the long sleep. And the more ghrelin and leptin changed, the more hunger changed. That confirmed our suspicions that these hormones are having a strong effect on appetite, she adds. In a month-long study, volunteers averaged 1,090 calories a day from snacks when they were allowed to sleep for 5.5 hours a night. But they averaged only 870 calories a day from snacks when they could sleep for 8.5 hours. The participants who could not leave the lab during the study were allowed to eat as much as they wanted. They got their extra calories mostly from high-carb snacks like pretzels, chips, crackers, popcorn, snack bars, muffins, cookies, pudding, ice cream, and candy. And they snacked more after 7 p.m. The less people are allowed to sleep, the more they snack. And it's not just because they're awake for more hours, says Dr. Knutson. Why would lack of sleep lead to less leptin and more ghrelin? Sleep restriction is associated with increased sympathetic nerve activity, that is, the flight or fight response, explains Dr. Knutson. That stress response could explain why sleep affects not just leptin secretion, but glucose metabolism and insulin resistance. And insulin resistance, which means that the body's insulin does a lousy job of lowering blood sugar levels, raises the risk of heart disease and diabetes. And sure enough, in a recent meta-analysis, short sleepers were more likely to develop diabetes than normal sleepers, says Dr. Knutson. Short sleepers are also more likely to end up with high blood pressure. Well, what's the next step? Dr. Knutson says that the next step is to see if extending sleep will make good things happen. Does it benefit insulin resistance, blood pressure, inflammatory markers, and appetite hormones? Time will tell. People have known for a long time that sugary beverages were not necessarily good for you, acknowledges Harvard's Dr. Walter Willett. But 40 years ago, most experts were largely worried that sodas would rot your teeth. Studies now link soft drinks and other sugar-sweetened beverages to a higher risk of weight gain, diabetes, the metabolic syndrome, heart disease, and gout. Sugary beverages are much more of a problem than they were 30 years ago, adds Dr. Willett. That's because we drink more, we've gained weight, and we're moving less. It's the amount of beverage consumed and the interaction with underlying insulin resistance due to inactivity and overweight, he explains. On top of that, we are consuming too many carbohydrate calories in general, and they are easier to overconsume in a beverage form. Even fruit juice has lost its all-you-can-drink clean bill of health. In a study of 51,000 women, those who increased their juice consumption over 4 years gained more weight, about 9 pounds more, than those who cut back on juice, who gained about 5 pounds. And women who drink more orange juice have a higher risk of gout. Juice is clearly more nutritious than soft drinks, but it is still liquid calories that don't curb your appetite as much as solid foods do. Juice is a little complicated because if someone is low in vitamin C and has a small glass of orange juice every day, that's a plus, says Dr. Willett. The problem is that many people consume juices as their primary beverage, and they drink 8 to 16 ounces at a time, not the classic 6-ounce juice glass. If you are highly lean and athletic, you can tolerate 3 or 4 glasses of juice a day, explains Dr. Willett. But that does not describe much of the American public. For many people who drink multiple glasses a day, the harm starts to outweigh the benefits. When a group of scientists issued advice on beverages in 2006, he notes, we recommended not more than 1 small glass of juice a day. The antioxidant vitamins C, E, and beta carotene were supposed to help prevent cancer, heart disease, memory loss, type 2 diabetes, cataracts, and macular degeneration. So far, though, the 3 antioxidants, C, E, and beta carotene, plus zinc, have succeeded with only 1, and that is slowing the pace of macular degeneration in older people who already have the eye disease. The randomized clinical trials for antioxidants have been very disappointing, says Harvard's Dr. Joanne Manson, who led many of these trials. What's more, some risks have been identified that suggest that high-dose antioxidant supplements should be avoided. We've reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. Please join me at the same time next month. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. It is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. See you next month.